Hello and welcome to Calvary Worship Center's podcast. My name is Richard Roop Narayan. A seemingly nondescript but God-fearing man decides to make a pilgrimage to a foreign land in order to participate in the festivities of a great feast known as Passover. The distance between his home and the city where the celebrations are taking place is close to 2,000 kilometers. He must travel by camel train or donkey or boat, but regardless of his favored mode of transportation, the journey was going to take at least 1 week to complete. But he wants to be there. Something is drawing him. Maybe it is the unseen hand of providence. Perhaps he hopes to meet old friends. Or it could just be that he is a part of the Jewish diaspora in Africa and wants to celebrate the great deliverance from Egypt with his people. Whatever his reason, he makes the trip and soon finds himself caught in a milieu of mixed emotions. On one hand, thousands of pilgrims from foreign lands are mixing with local celebrants, meeting up with old friends and making new acquaintances. The joy in the atmosphere is palpable. On the other hand, there are whisperings about another event that is taking place simultaneously in the city and which is shrouded in secrecy. The conversations are hushed, not because this odd event is unusual, but because of one particular individual who's part of it. It was common to see condemned criminals marching through city streets on Passover week, bearing their crossbars to the place of crucifixion. But there was something different about this particular crucifixion, and it involved a third man. Simon had heard about this man. All the way down in Cyrene, the reports of miracles at the hand of this man had been in circulation for the past 3 years. He had heard of miracles of healing from all kinds of sicknesses and diseases. He was told how this Nazarene man had repeatedly cast out devils with his word, causing many of his fellow celebrants and priests to conclude his power must have come from Beelzebub, the prince of devils. But then the man had refuted their accusations with simple logic, saying that if Satan cast out Satan, then he will destroy his own kingdom. He had heard about the raising of Lazarus from death and about similar resurrections of a young man and a little girl. The news of this man's exploits began to spread like wildfire through the region when others testified that he had walked on water, cured leprosy, blindness, hemorrhage, and fed over 5,000 people with just 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Then there was his teaching. Stuff that no one had heard before. He talked about heaven and hell, demons and angels, his Father and the Holy Spirit, and answered tough questions on the trot in such a simple and unequivocal manner that it was hard to dispute his sincerity and truthfulness. He spoke with such authority that even the winds and seas obeyed him. He had hurt no one, and none could accuse him of wrongdoing. So why was he being crucified? Why was he being lumped with 2 other murderers? What did he do to justify a similar sentence? He pasted the bits and pieces of information gleaned from fellow pilgrims, and from what he could tell, it was out of envy that the priests had plotted this man's death. The increasingly large following of this man was eroding the power base of the religious establishment and depleting their treasuries. To secure their power and wealth, they had forged alliances with the puppet king and pressured their colonial rulers to find a man guilty of blasphemy for claiming to be equal to God, a charge that under their law required death. Simon, however, was a just man. And talks of the injustice meted out to this man sapped the joy from his spirit and forced him to make a detour from his mapped out destination. He left home for the house of rejoicing, but chose instead to visit the house of mourning. Sure. More people in the city this weekend were rejoicing in the Passover celebration than those who were mourning the impending slaughter of the Passover lamb. For no one, it seemed, could make the connection between these two events. None could see that the true Passover was passing through them on his way to the altar to be sacrificed for them. None could see that this Passover lamb was going to bring an end to all animal sacrifices and complete the picture that was being painted by Passover feasts through the centuries. But Simon was different. He was searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who was in him was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that will follow. And so he worked his way through the crowd just for a glimpse of this innocent man. He managed to make his way through to the front just in time to see the approach of the Nazarene. Two murderers were way in the distance. Why was this man so far back, he wondered. Shortly, he received the answer. The man was bleeding profusely. He left a trail of blood behind him. Soldiers were yelling obscenities at him because he was lagging behind. Sundong must see these men dead and removed from the city, and so this whole sordid saga was a time-sensitive matter. This third man, however, was putting the executioners on the clock, and they would not stand for it. They must pick up the pace, but with the Nazarene unable to bear the weight of the cross, they needed a substitute. The centurion looked around at the hundreds of people that lined the way of the skull. Whom will he choose? You guessed it. He chose Simon. One question that piqued my curiosity is why did the Roman soldier identify Simeon out of the hundreds that lined the roadside to be the one to assist Christ in carrying his cross? Something must have caught that soldier's eye to make him compel Simon to pick up the crossbar. In an interesting study, someone suggested that the three parties involved in this event, Jesus, the Roman soldier, and Simon, actually realized an old prophecy that came from the lips of Noah. Here is that prophecy. Then Noah said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants he shall be to his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be his servant." Genesis 9, 25 through 27. The theory is that Jesus descended from the line of Shem, the Roman from the line of Japheth, and Simeon from the line of Ham. Simeon bears the cross of Jesus on authority of the Roman, and in so doing brings to fulfillment Noah's prophecy concerning his sons. The theory sounds plausible. However, we do know that even though prophecies must come to pass, they are not forced into realization, but rather unfold in the normal course of human beings expressing the power of their free will in making decisions that seem best for them at the time. In other words, while God may foreordain outcomes, he does not foreordain decisions. Those belong to us, and we are going to be held accountable for them. So even if Simon must be the Ham who's to serve Shem under Japheth's orders, the Roman soldier must still have a personal and natural reason for his actions and decisions. What caused him to single out Simon from the crowd for this shameful task? As we keep in mind that the cross was associated with shame and humiliation, we are forced to press these accompanying vices into the selection criteria. The candidate will come in for his share of humiliation, even as he bore the cross for another, for only those within the confines of this exchange would know he was not the criminal, but just the substitute. For this reason, the Roman soldier would not chance dragging a local from the crowd. He needed to pick on someone who looked different and who seemed defenseless. I suggest that Simon was picked out for this degrading task because he was a minority. In Acts 13:1, we read of Simon, who was called Niger. The word Niger means black one, and many believe this person is the same as Simon of Cyrene. Whether or not he was of a darker skin tone or not, we cannot say. But we know he was from North Africa, and so it is fair to say he did not look like the local Judean people. Perhaps his attire or disposition or speech was different from theirs. Maybe the soldier realized this man was alone and defenseless. In the end, it may just be a combination of all these factors that made this soldier come to the conclusion that Simon could be brought into servitude without resistance. Simon was marginalized. He was deemed to be of less value than the dominant race in Palestine. And so Simon could have cried racism. He could have fought for his rights, but he did no such thing. He chose instead to take the higher ground and accept the cross, not in slavish obedience, but freely and willingly and lovingly, understanding that he was there for that reason, and it did not matter what human reasons were used for his selection. God had chosen him and ordained him for this moment. As he climbed the hill, he could see the sovereign hand of God at work in his life. From this mountaintop view, he was released from the pettiness of self-defense and self-assertion and gladly surrendered to God's higher purposes. This was the enslavement that brings freedom. The crowd may have felt sorry for him or deemed his selection unfortunate, but he chose to believe that all things work together for good to them who love God and who are called according to his purpose. Like Joseph, he was going to take what man meant for evil and turn it for good. Like Naaman the Syrian general, who used his leprosy to win his greatest battle and find the one true God, he chose to see his selection not as a reason for self-assertion or retaliation, but as a peculiar benefit. It was his race and color and minority status that had given him this opportunity. It was his difference that brought him into alliance with Jesus. It was his handicap that became the doorway to glory. His inferior racial status proved to be the gold in the dirt. In this, Simon teaches us that there are always at least two ways of looking at our disadvantages in life. We can choose to lament our color or lack of opportunities in life, or broken relationships, or financial hardships as strikes against us, and leverage these as excuses for apathy and failure. Or we can see them as opportunities for growth and advancement. The great success stories in life are not of men and women who built empires on the backs of inherited wealth, but of those who came to fortune and fame from rags and obscurity and brokenness. Great stories are from people who fought the odds, stacked against them, and prevailed. They used hardship as a ramp to discover and to exploit some secret wealth hidden inside of them. Let us then stop lamenting our lot in life. Let us cease walking around with a chip on our shoulders, crying foul at everything that seems to take advantage of our status. Let us choose to believe that as children of God, all things are working in our lives to produce God's glorious end, and that is our confirmation to the image of His Son. God bless you.